Good afternoon. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and we are here in PEPCA Auditorium of the Aspen Institute for our final High Notes talk of the 2019 season. This talk is happening live at noon on Wednesday and will be broadcast by Aspen Public Radio, the voice of classical music in Aspen, on Thursday at 2 p.m. and is available as a podcast at all times. I'm joined today by Mane Galoyan, is that okay? Galoyan, soprano, Kelly O'Connor, a mezzo-soprano, and Jonathan Biss, a pianist. So I could start by saying one of these things is not like the others, but that's true of the repertoire we're representing here today as well, because Mane and Kelly will be part of our Mahler II on Sunday at 4 p.m., final Sunday concert of the season, and Jonathan is playing Beethoven's third piano concerto on Friday, the final Aspen Chamber Symphony concert at 6 p.m. on Friday. I thought I'd just start with a few resume points. I'm always highly selective, and the artists who come to these High Notes, generally I could have 30 index cards full of their accomplishments. But I thought I would mention that Mane started her training as a singer in Yerevan, in Armenia, and has been a prize winner at many, many competitions, but I'll mention the Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow and the Eleanor McCollum competition in Houston, which is very significant in our country. She was a student here in Aspen. What years?
2017.
Uh-huh. Fantastic. Is your Met debut coming up this season?
Yes.
Yes.
And in Queen of Spades.
Yes. Pique Dame.
Pique Dame.
Yeah. Fantastic. But Mane has also sung with the Houston Grand Opera, but also the Houston Symphony and Dallas Symphony and the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. We're going to come back to some of those projects in a minute. Kelly O'Connor, what I have here is many important appearances with the Houston Symphony, Dallas Symphony, BBC Scottish Symphony, basically all of the Mahler repertoire. Is that correct to say?
That's true.
Yes. I especially like the fact that John Adams's The Gospel According to the Other Mary was written for Kelly O'Connor, but also that you were part of the premiere of Aina Damar of Osvaldo Golijov. That's just a fabulous work.
It is, and it was with Robert Spano.
We
recorded that. So.
I regret that I think you were not a student here.
I was not.
But you have been a guest artist with us.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being back. And then Jonathan Biss. Jonathan is clearly one of the great pianists of his generation, winner of the Leonard Bernstein Award, the Andrew Wolf Award, the Martin Siegel Award, the Avery Fisher Career Grant, the Gilmore Award. That's just a tiny fraction of the awards. Jonathan has been with us in Aspen, of course, many times, but I think last year became co-director of the Marlborough Festival with Mitsuko Uchida, and is also now on the faculty of the Curtis Institute, which is also his alma mater. Jonathan comes from sort of American music royalty. His parents, Miriam Fried and Paul Biss, very, very important string teachers and performers, and his grandmother, Raya Garbasova, for whom Samuel Barber wrote his cello concerto. I once visited your grandmother with Larry Lesser. We were in Chicago for a meeting, and Larry said, I always go out to DeKalb. And so I went, and what a great lady.
Yeah, she was like this big and that big of a personality.
Yes. Fantastic. Jonathan also has had a significant work with living composers, and I'll mention just one, a project for the Beethoven year in which five composers have been commissioned each to write a piano concerto in some way connected to one of the five Beethoven piano concertos. And Jonathan's is with Caroline Shaw, a composer we all admire deeply. And you are paired with the third, is that right?
I'm actually playing all of the pairings. Uh-huh. But the piece that Caroline wrote was paired with the third. Yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
Wonderful. So, actually, I'm going to start with you, Jonathan, because you also have a tremendous project. Well, first of all, Jonathan, over the past two seasons, played all of the Beethoven piano sonatas for us here in Aspen, and has a thing on Coursera called Exploring Beethoven's Piano Sonatas. And tell us the scope. How many hours?
You can probably see my exhaustion and anxiety as you ask the question. By the time it's completed, which I've actually finished all the filming, but not all the lectures are online yet, it'll be 28 hours worth of lectures on the Beethoven sonatas, which do cover all 32 sonatas.
Mm-hmm. And you're also in progress with releasing them all as a complete recorded set.
Yes, same kind of the same timeline. I've actually finished the last recording, but it's not yet released. But I have recorded them all, so I can like retire or die or something. Yeah.
Well, no. What happens? It's like yo-yo. What happens is now you can prepare for your next cycle of all the sonatas.
Or that. Yeah.
If one of us wanted to go to Coursera and acquire this, how does that happen?
You just go to the Coursera website, coursera.org, and the class is called Exploring Beethoven's Piano Sonatas. You can also find it via my website, which is just jonathanbiss.com.
But it's coming up on like 200,000 people who have experienced some of this.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, when I started doing it, I thought to myself, well, I didn't really have any expectation, but to the extent that I had any, I thought 500 people will sign up. 100 will actually watch, 20 will like it, you know? And but to be honest, I thought that's good enough. Like, that's a way of reaching 20 people and, you know, really delving into this music with and for them, you know, that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And instead, when it ended up being, again, literally hundreds of thousands from, I think, 150 countries, and knowing that these are people who I really don't think have anything in common with one another, including level of familiarity with the music, other than a desire to learn more about Beethoven, that really moves me, I have to say. And we get really used to being told that classical music is dying, right? Like if you're a classical musician, like it's like part of the background noise, like, well, obviously classical music is dying. It's like, no, actually, if 200,000 people sign up for a class to do a deep dive into Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas, pieces that are 200 years old. I think I'm not saying we don't have challenges, but the interest is clearly there.
Well, if our singers don't mind, I'm going to stick with Beethoven for a minute, but I think you both have sung Beethoven 9 at least. Yes. No, not yet. Well, it's coming.
Don't worry, it's coming.
Yes.
it's always coming.
How about Perfido? Perfido?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There we go. It's a commonplace, but I think there's a lot of truth in it, that Beethoven used the 32 piano sonatas, which engaged him, the writing for piano throughout all of his life, as a laboratory. And that he was developing ideas about form, about pianistic technique in them. How would you compare the third piano concerto, or indeed all five piano concertos? Are they the result of the experiments?
I think in some ways they are. I think probably the most critical difference between the sonatas and the concertos is that he never really imagined that the sonatas would be played publicly. And that was probably very freeing for him, that he could write this music that was way ahead of its time in terms of form, in terms of language, in terms of difficulty. And if people couldn't handle it, there wasn't really any skin off his back, right? But with pieces like piano concertos or symphonies that were going to be played in public concerts, he needed those concerts to be successful, right? And so it was necessary for the ideas to be fully fleshed out, and it was necessary for musicians to be able to play them, and it was necessary for audiences to be able to understand them. And so that means a lot of different things. Maybe they're a little bit less adventurous than the sonatas, but it also means that the ideas are there. They're fully fleshed out. They're incredibly strongly etched. And I think no better example of that than the C minor concerto, which is an incredibly daring piece, but also it just is a piece with the full belligerence of his personality on display.
It is emphatic, isn't it? Let's just stay with the idea of the recital for a moment, because in Beethoven's time there was no such thing as a major recital hall where someone would play a solo piano recital. When does that come about?
Well, Liszt in the 19th century was the first person to play piano recitals, you know, full programs of solo piano music, although probably not yet in venues as large as the ones that we use today. I think that's probably more of a 20th century phenomenon, the recital in a large hall. But the piano recital as a genre came into being, you know, a generation or two after Beethoven's death.
And it would also be true, typically Beethoven, when he was presenting his works in concert, so they would be symphonic or large choral works, but it would be all Beethoven. The idea of having one of your favorite Mozart concertos and one of your favorite Haydn symphonies, etc., no.
Yeah, and there's that famous, you mentioned A Perfido, there's that famous concert, and I should remember the year, but where...
1808.
Yeah, 08, it was over 3 hours where they... I think premiered the fourth piano concerto and the fifth and sixth symphonies and A Perfido and what's the orator, Christ on...
Christ on the Mountain of Olives was in the 1800 concerts. But
right, so it's that, what are the Mass
in C.
The Mass in C, that's right.
And the Choral Fantasy.
And then there were solo improvisations and they ended with the Choral Fantasy and it was like February in Vienna and apparently it was freezing in the hall, and the seats were very uncomfortable, and there was just a lot of complaining from every corner of the room.
Yes. No, I think it was about 4.5 hours of concert.
That's a lot of hours.
To whet your appetites, next summer being a very major Beethoven year, we are going to recreate that concert. It'll be warm. Yeah.
Yeah. I participated in a recreation of that concert once, and it was great, again, but it was like indoors, and with modern amenities, like seat cushions, and people seem to enjoy it, so.
Yeah, yeah. And bathrooms. Yeah. No, but actually, one of Beethoven's first important public presentations in Vienna, which was in 1800, he had intended the third piano concerto to be on that program, with the first symphony and in Christ on the Mount of Olives. And then, for reasons that are a little unclear still, withdrew it, and it was a couple of years before it was played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to tell the whole story, but the genesis of this concerto is a little bit complicated and definitely drawn out. And it's maybe not surprising, because the first two concerti, wonderful as they are sort of purely classical. You can observe that Mozart was the model for them. And in the second, which actually is written first, particularly it uses a Mozart orchestra and it's of Mozart proportions. The first is larger, but a lot of that still applies. The third concerto is a piece where he's moved beyond that, and there are ideas which are really daring in it. So it's not surprising that he needed some time to perfect them.
Well, so one more nerdy question.
My specialty. Yeah.
The Beethoven Third Piano Concerto is Opus 37, but it is written about the time as Opus 27. Why is that?
I don't know. Again, I mean, there are so many peculiarities of Beethoven's opus numbers. There are pieces that he held back. Again, the first piano concerto is written after the second piano concerto, and in that case, apparently, he thought the one that was eventually called the first was a more impressive piece, and he wanted that to be the calling card. Mm. There are pieces that he didn't think maybe that highly of, and therefore he didn't publish them for a long time, and then maybe when he needed the income, they got... So the opus numbers in general don't that precisely reflect timing of compositions, but I have to say I don't know the specifics of why the C minor was held back.
Well, I'll hazard a guess. And one thing is, Beethoven's opus numbers are not... have no relation to the order of composition. They are the order of publication. And thus there are many works that have no opus number because they were not published in his lifetime. And it seems as though he didn't write out the whole piano part even for the first performance. And then he was busy with other projects and didn't get around to writing it out until a couple of years, and thus it got a much later opus number.
Which is something Mozart did very often. That was less common for Beethoven, but yeah, it's interesting.
But the famous Mozart Kerschel numbers are an attempt to use the exact order of writing of composition, some of which is conjectural, but anyway, they are an attempt. The Bach catalog numbers are by groups. So all the cantatas are numbers one through whatever, and then all the solo works for violin are a group that way. So they have no relation to anything, really.
Yeah. I think we just don't have enough information about Bach to really know when things were written. Yeah, it would be so much guesswork.
Yep. Okay, I'm going to come back to you because we want to talk about cadenza, so remind me about that. Let's turn to Mahler. And I wanted to start because you both have sung a lot of Mahler. Mahler in his symphonies employs a solo voice in, I think, 2, 3, 4, and 8, and Das Lied and Des Knaben Wunderhorn. These are all big, big orchestral works. And then there are songs, but never an opera. And Mahler was one of the greatest opera conductors of all time. So what's going on with that, do you think?
I mean, Das Lied von der Erde is almost an opera. Uh-huh. To me, I mean, he just found the medium that works for him, and I think the drama is there and it didn't need costumes and a set. Hmm. You know, he's really created this whole sound world that just, I think, beautifully allows the listener to create it in their own minds. You know, I was just speaking about how being here and performing Mahler is perfect, because I feel like he would have gone outside of his compositional hut and seen this mountain. Uh-huh. You know, and this is what he wrote about, and I think this is exactly what we hear in the orchestra.
Hmm. Yeah. What about Mahler's writing for voice? Is there like a single Fach, a single type of voice that's great for Mahler, or are there different requirements in different works, and how do you place yourselves as Mahler singers?
I think his writing for the voice is pretty universal. I don't think you... Of course, because the orchestra is very big, you cannot cast a singer with a smaller voice.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, for Mahler Fourth, you don't necessarily have to have a big voice sing it, because it's the little boy's dream of the heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be big, although it has to project. But I don't think... It's not like Wagner, or I think it's pretty universal.
Yeah. So a more lyric style than a dramatic style.
I think it's very combined, and it's possible to take both from any a singer who is capable to project and perform.
Uh-huh.
Really, the humanity of the voice spoke to him in so many ways, and he composed a lot for middle voice. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the songs for baritone or mezzo, I can almost sing anything he wrote, which is great. I like him, but and you know, some of the stuff is so exposed. I was just speaking about this, the movement in Mahler 2. It really comes out of nothing, and it's almost daunting to sing it because it feels like you're almost a cappella. You know, that you're so exposed and you're by yourself. But I find he does that with individual instruments, too. Mm-hmm. You know, so many people have solos and they're vulnerable and they're so exposed. And that's what he liked to hear. I mean, you have these humongous forces, like every horn that's in Colorado is probably playing, you know, but at the same time, someone's going to have a solo and it's going to be just like, just the most personal thing. So you can feel, you know, the solitude as well as the expansion. And it's like, he just creates so many different textures.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, did Ossidor leave?
Yes.
Okay. and maybe you've been in rehearsal already or no?
Not yet.
Okay. Because Mahler does, for this symphony, call for 10 horns and 10 trumpets. And
it's all double cast.
Yeah.
They're all. And
there are two harp parts, but he offers that you could have multiple harps playing each part. So.
And the organ.
And the organ, yes. Well, let's stick with the singing aspect. What about flexibility? What about, you definitely said you need that ping to get across the orchestra, but it's primarily slow tempos, is that right?
He does like the slow tempi, but this is where comes the question of breath control and being able to send the voice far enough without screaming or without pushing. And he doesn't write a lot of coloraturas. Yes, it's always very big and stretched, which has its own difficulties.
Especially at altitude. I mean, that is a thing,
yes,
too. You know? I mean, yep. You have to kind of, I'm going to have to plan some extra breaths in there in case there needs to be an emergency evacuation. But you don't know. I mean, in the moment, it could be, you know, because you just have to plan. But I also always try to embrace that those moments is, they're kind of necessary in Mahler, and they're beautiful when they happen. I mean, it doesn't have to be like a perfect stream of sound. You know, I mean, he wants the message and the text to come across in the most personal way. Hmm. So I try to say, okay, well, I just was a little shaky there because I was emotional. but that's part of it.
It's a live performance, yes. Yeah. It's a live performance, yeah. And the emotion will, even in that shake, in that shakiness, the emotion will show.
Well, I honestly don't ever understand in Mahler 2 how you can keep it together emotionally. It's so beautiful and so heartfelt.
I'm going to cry on stage.
You just wait till the end, and then it's amazing. Auf Erstehen, we're all crying.
Every time I was reading the score or practicing, and I was imagining the tent and the orchestra, the chorus, the soloists, and all the people sitting, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to cry when this happens.
Well, of course, the moment where the chorus comes in with Auf Erstehen is just one of the great coup de théâtre in all of music. But my favorite moment is for you is O Glaube, which I just think, ah.
Well, you know, and I think that means so much because those are words that Mahler himself wrote.
Yes.
You know, he wrote the words from where I start, O Glaube, to the end. And it's all just so effusive and just faithful. And it's just such a wonderful outpouring of what he felt.
Yeah, I love that point that, you know, he cared so much about the voice. But he, I think, cared about the voice because he cared so much about text.
Definitely.
And then for this work, he started with a couple of stanzas of an existing poem, which he accidentally heard at a funeral, but it wasn't enough. And so then he wrote his own stanzas to follow.
Yeah.
Then, all right, that's some Mahler. It is a very large work. I don't know how we're going to stage manage it, but it is fairly common to let the singers be off stage for the extremely long first movement.
Yes. I think so. I think that's the normal.
Minutes? 35
I
mean, minutes the first moment?
Yeah. I think so. That's the normal.
I think we should be out.
Because otherwise I think it's distracting. I mean, you know, in Mahler's third, the first movement is like 40 minutes or something. I mean, it would just be distracting. Yeah. You know, I think it's great for the audience just to enjoy that.
Well, and also here, because it's so dry, if you were sitting on stage needing to have an intravenous hydration system.
A camelback. We'll just put the camelback on. Yeah.
Great. Okay, well, I'm going to take a detour back to Beethoven, only because this work, what is the cadenza situation and what are you going to do?
Cadenza situation, it sounds like a novel.
Yes.
John Le Carré, maybe. So there are some of the Beethoven concerti, he left multiple cadenzas. This one he wrote only one. And I mean, there are people who are interested in sort of authentic practice who would say, well, really the thing to do is to write or even improvise your own. And I respect that in theory, but the Beethoven cadenzas are so extraordinary that for me to not play them feels unthinkable. And in this particular, there is a specific reason why I can't imagine not playing his cadenza, because one of the really remarkable innovations of the third concerto is normally in a classical concerto, you have the cadenza at the end of the first, towards the end of the first movement, and there's a cadential trill, and then the soloist is done for the first movement, and the coda is the orchestra alone playing something which just sort of recaps the material. And what's really kind of an innovation and really a startling moment is that the piano actually is very much involved in the coda of the first movement, which begins in this very ghostly fashion. The timpani plays an important role in the whole first movement, and the coda is this very strange, unearthly kind of dialogue between timpani and piano. And the way that Beethoven sets this up at the end of the cadenza is really one of his most incredible ideas. You know, you have what seems like is destined to be the cadential trill, and then it just goes off the rails, you know. And there's a second trill which is a little bit further from C minor, and a third which is even further, and a fourth which is even further. And it really just creates the most unbelievable atmosphere for the coda. And so if I thought that in some world I would have an idea that was 3% as good as that, I would think, maybe I'll write my own cadenza, but ain't going to happen. So I play Beethoven. Yeah.
Well, continuing with our nerdishness, because you mentioned the keys, the first movement... Well, the second movement is in a very unusual key.
Yeah.
And what's the story there?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. So, and I just want to preface this by saying that this may sound like getting into music theory weeds, but you cannot know any of what I'm about to say, and you will still feel its impact. You don't need to know anything about the circle of fifths, but yeah. So the C minor Beethoven concerto is obviously in C minor, and normal key for the slow movement might be E flat major, which is the relative major, or A flat major, which is one link down the circle of fifths from that. But instead, he writes it in E major, which is basically as far from C minor as you possibly could be. And the first movement ends with this like blaze of C minor, and then when this E major chord comes in the first movement, it really sounds like a mirage. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you I've played this piece as often, maybe, as any other piano concerto, and it's happened to me more than once, even after many, many playings, that I put my hand down and play the first chord and worry that I played the wrong chord. Because it doesn't sound possible that that could be it. And that's the whole idea, is that after this first movement, which is so unrelentingly dramatic, that you're somehow transported to some kind of dream state. It is really incredible.
Now, one of my piano teachers told a story, which I don't believe, but I will repeat, that she... heard Arthur Rubinstein start the C minor sonata, Pathétique, in C sharp minor, and proceed to just play the whole movement in C sharp minor. So.
Was there like a reason behind it, or it just happened?
No, I guess, a moment of abstraction, and he just played the wrong chord and thought.
I mean, if he could do it, like, chapeau, honestly. Yeah. I mean, that would be very hard to play in C sharp minor. I mean, he probably could. He was amazing, but that's still like pretty remarkable.
Though
it's like nothing should be in C sharp minor.
Words,
really?
Words.
Yes. Interesting. Words doesn't, just doesn't lie well in the voice?
No.
Interesting. I once sat down with first all the piano sonatas, all the symphonies, all the concertos, and then all the string quartets, and then all the trios, and wrote out what the keys were of all the movements just to verify for myself how weird it is that it's in E major. Yeah. But my conviction, not borne out by any facts necessarily, is that C major plays an important role as the parallel major, both in the first movement and then, of course, the last movement ends in C major. And a thing that Beethoven does very often within a work is the key centers spell something out. Mm-hmm. And just a tiny example, the cello sonata, opus 69, has a very unusual set of key relationships in the first movement, which are A, E, and F sharp minor. But those notes are the opening motive of the piece.
Yeah.
And so it's a thing.
And I mean, keys meant something to Beethoven for sure. And I mean, in this key, I'm really clear that the E major is meant to represent some kind of utopia, because as if the opening of the slow movement didn't make it clear enough, he actually revisits this strange E major in an episode in the last movement. And in both cases, opening of the slow movement and that place in the last movement, he asks the pianist to just hold the pedal down through many harmonies that don't belong together. Mm. And so there is this sort of desire to create kind of a sense of a mirage, you know, which is so unlike, you know, the sound world of the rest of the piece, which is, you know, tough.
Mm. Well, I'm now totally switching gears. I want to do two segments. And the first is on touring life. In many instances, it can be very different for an instrumentalist and a singer. But you both do a lot of orchestral work. Would you say primarily orchestral work, or a mixture of opera and orchestra?
Go ahead. I think for me, it's a mix, fair mix of opera and orchestra. Mm-hmm. I like both equally, I'd say. But it is still a lot of traveling. Mm-hmm. And for you?
Yeah, I do mostly concert work. I've just found that it's kind of the medium that I respond to. I feel much more comfortable on stage with an orchestra than seeing them down there in the pit. I feel like they're so far away from me. And I'm so alone. So I really love, and it's very interesting because you will encounter singers that hate it. They're like, oh my gosh, you're so exposed. You're all alone up there. You don't have a, you know, costume.
See, I feel like I'm naked when I'm singing with the orchestra.
Isn't that funny? I know.
And I love having the costume and the scenery. And
like
but
I said.
I feel the enormous support from the orchestra behind me. But also, the hardest is just to sing with the piano, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you do piano recitals?
Not enough. It's kind of a... Unfortunately, it's not as popular as I wish. I mean, I really, really enjoy, and there's an unlimited amount of repertoire to explore. I'm doing a recital this year, and I wanted to do all pieces that no one ever does, because, you know, it's very easy if you never do recitals to just say, oh, I'll do these Defaya songs, or I'll do, you know, the Debussy chansons de Bellitis, things that people are always...
Those.
I know, but people always do them. So, you know, I've been trying to find just these off the beaten path. You know, because there's so much repertoire that we're not even exploring. But sometimes it's hard if you aren't famous or really well-known to do recitals. It's kind of
true,
a shame because
true.
I wish I could just do so much of it. But I'll take all the Mahler. It's fine. But, it is a lot of traveling. I mean, it's probably easier for all of us because we don't bring our instruments.
True.
So that's a little bit easier. But you also don't know what you're going to get every place, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's always a guessing game, I guess.
That's, you know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I know that living with your instrument inside you brings a lot of its own challenges, but yeah, I do have a certain envy of this thing of it's like you have ultimate ownership of the instrument that you play every single time, whereas for us it's... Yeah, it's a huge thing to show up, and you have no idea what's going to be in front of you.
Yeah. Right.
Hmm. Well, so if you're singing at Vienna State Opera, maybe there's no rehearsal, but typically if you're going to do a role, you would show up and have 4 to 6 weeks in some city, and then on to the next.
Yes, definitely when doing opera gigs, you stay in one place for longer, typically, unless it's somewhere in Germany, in Europe, where it's a revival and you get a videotape of the opera, and then they're like, here we go, you're blocking.
Well, is it easier or harder to spend a month or even longer in a city than to sweep in, sing, and sweep out?
It depends on many aspects. It's easier on one side because you become more familiar with the cast members, with the staging, with the pace of it. And I think it's much easier when you're younger and you don't have a family and you love traveling and it's just another adventure. But I imagine it's much harder for people who have families and kids. And then when the kids are of school age, it's completely different. I don't have experience in it, but I imagine it's very hard for people who have families.
Yeah. I don't have children. So I just take every job. I'm not really home ever, but, I'm just taking that now as it comes, because at some point that'll stop too. But I think it depends on the city too, the weather. I mean, there's so many elements. I remember one time I was doing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream and I had the tiniest part. I had like 3 lines at the very end and I had to be in Toronto for 3 months.
Cold?
In like winter? The winter.
No.
And I kept thinking, I literally just have 3 lines at the end. I don't really, so needless to say, I was like, can I just sing a mall or two somewhere? Can we just like not do this again? So it depends on the role as well, because you need it to be fulfilling, in that way it makes the work and the waiting. For me, it makes it worth it. But you do have time to make friends and, see a city and all that, because this is,
as
you said, in and out.
But I hate when it's winter, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I hate gigs in the winter because it's always hard. You always have to take care of your instrument. Mm. You cannot get sick. You can't be too warm, too cold. You can't eat this, the other one. Although I try not to follow all these things and just go as it, live my life as I would. But it still takes a lot of discipline and planning on our side to, because it's our responsibility to take care of ourselves, our instrument, our body, because the instrument is inside you and it changes every day. It changes with your mood. It changes what time of the day it is. Did you sleep enough? Did you sleep too much?
Is there too much?
Yeah, can be.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, when I sleep a little too, I love sleeping, but I notice if I sleep too long, and then I wake up with a kind of baritone voice.
So, Jonathan, how many concert dates do you do in a year?
Less than I used to. I mean, there was a time when it was close to 100, and now I do it more like 75. Sometimes it swells to 80. And even that is a little bit too much, I think. Your priorities change as you get older. I can remember a time when it was just de facto exciting to get on a plane somewhere and to, like, even just to like open the door to your new hotel room. And I don't know, the more I've done it, the more I feel like I have to be musically fulfilled by what I'm doing, or I would rather be home, actually. Which actually it's a good thing anyway to feel that way, because then it forces you to feel 110% invested in absolutely everything you do, which is obviously how it should be. You have the responsibility to the music and to the people you're playing for. I find that I'm sure it's the same for you guys. It's just the psychic energy involved in playing a concert is a fairly enormous thing. And you just cannot re-find it an unlimited number of times.
Huh. Yeah, we always need to recharge. Always.
So you live in Philadelphia?
Yes.
I was talking with someone, I'm going to say it's Eric Owens, but I'm not certain, who actually went a couple of years without having a home because he was on the road so much. He just thought, why have an apartment?
Yeah.
It's just a big expense.
Hopefully at least he was doing operas, which meant he was based somewhere for long periods.
Right, because he's doing a lot of rings, and so that's really a long slog. Huh. So that's touring, or some things on touring. What about teaching life? Because it would be obvious for you, Jonathan, that you would be playing fewer outside concerts because you have a commitment to teaching.
Yeah, and it's a hard balancing act. I mean, for example, because next year I'm playing the Beethoven Cycle so many places, some of which are West Coast, some of which are Europe. I am actually taking the year off from the teaching. I mean, teaching is, in some ways, I don't know if you guys, if you do any of it, it's in some ways, it's the hardest thing to do. And the biggest expenditure of energy, and it's also amazing. I think, first of all, I'm sure everyone on the stage, I love music to distraction, but sometimes I just think there is something, even though music, playing a concert is an act of sharing, there's something incredibly egocentric about, like, you need to carve out all the time alone to do the work you do, and like the day of the concert, everything has to be organized so that come, in the case of Aspen, 6 p.m., I will be in the absolute optimal shape to play the concert. And it's so self-directed that sometimes it makes me want to scream into a pillow, you know? And what's amazing about teaching is it's dealing with music, but it's trying to reach someone else, which is really, I just love that. And it's also, I think all of us, even those of us who like thinking about music, like it's still so much of what we do as performers is by instinct. It's inevitably by instinct, and it needs to be. But then when suddenly, you know, you have this person who you need to actually justify your belief system to, it's like you have to really figure your stuff out. And I've learned, I really do genuinely believe that I've learned more from teaching than my students have. It's an incredible education. There was some, I think, pianists who said that they learned to play the piano first from their teachers and then from their students. Mm-hmm. And I've found that to be true.
Well, because you're both mostly performing and not teaching, do you give master classes or have you?
I have done some of that, and actually, like you're saying, it's to put into words what we do and have to explain, because I definitely go by instinct, and I feel kind of bad that I can't explain what I do, but in certain ways, I know that works for me, and it's so individual. You know, I know some singers that have, like, every half step is a different image, and I'm already overwhelmed, like, the pillow is over my head. But, you know, for me, I just really try to be free and still engaged, but I really can't overthink it. To me, it's too much. So it's really wonderful to have to find ways to say that or try to get people to achieve that, you know, in their own way, because it is so individual. I mean, you can have teachers that also work for you and don't. I mean, it's a very daunting task, I think, actually. It's a big responsibility.
It is like another relationship in your life. You have your own relationship or you don't, or you have your relationship with your manager, and you have your relationship with your teacher, because it is very important. I don't teach, sometimes my friends ask for advice, and even then I'm very scared and conservative to give advice, because I think I'm too young to myself, and I have so many things yet to learn. And advice, yes, sometimes master classes to younger people who I can just say, translate the words, go deeper in the text. Yeah, what does this mean? And that, but I would never mess with their breath control, their support. I would say, this is how I do it, but then I would be scared to ruin what they have.
Mm-hmm. Well, but let's flip it then, because I know some singers with major, major international careers lasting 20 years who still constantly are working with the teacher.
Yes.
How is that for you?
I definitely agree that you can have great ears, be very detailed and stuff, but to hear from the mouth to the ear is not very realistic. Of course, you hear yourself, but we always, always need a pair of ears to be like, it can be a coach that you trust very much. But I think the voice and your body changes all the time, and it is very important to be in touch with a teacher that works for you, because you just can't hear yourself enough to judge why are certain things happening. Mm-hmm. Especially from 20s to 30s, or even mid-20s to 30s to 35, that the voice changes all the time, and you constantly have to adjust the technique or the way you approach things. And even after that, I definitely think checking in with a teacher is always a great idea.
Mm-hmm. How about you?
I agree. My teacher recently passed away, and it's been, that's the nature, you know, of things, but she was like a second mother to me, and even if I had, you know, an emotional problem or psychological problem, she could fix it. So they fulfill so many voids in your life, you know. I mean, I went to her for so many things. So it's very daunting, and it's also lovely, I find, you know, I trust Robert Spano. I mean, I'm hoping he would ever tell me if something, you know, but it's nice to have these conductors that you can also trust, that you maybe, you know, could hear something and tell you if something's changing. But I also agree that the older you get, the more it cooperates and does, you know, what you think it's going to do. But yeah, those years before 35 or so, I feel like it just... okay, that's what happened, and I didn't plan on it, but I mean...
It changes,
you know,
every day.
Yeah, basically it totally does. It really, really does.
Well, Renee Fleming was here last week giving two really beautiful classes, but a big preoccupation on this visit for her was working with the young singer, saying, you think you're hearing, but you are not hearing anything like what we are hearing.
Yes, yes. So.
Well, that's why we're very lucky that we can record ourselves as well. At this day and age, you can actually listen to yourself, you know, and even though that's really tough, I have to say sometimes.
I hate listening to myself in the recordings.
Is that what happened? Is that what I sound like? You know, but at least we have that, you know, that's a benefit that we can do that and check on ourselves as well. I mean, that wasn't available to people, you know, in my teacher's generation, so it's very helpful.
I do think that's one of the great frustrations of being a performer. I mean, we don't have your problem of like the sound is coming from inside your body, which is another obstacle to objectivity. But even for us, that I will never know what my sound sounds like there. Mm-hmm. And that's so frustrating, you know. And I mean, recording is sometimes a pretty good approximation, but you always wonder how much, you know, is the microphone picking up? You know, how similar is that? You know, that's really the right, and you have to have, in the end, it comes down to just like faith, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. You kind of have to believe
in yourself and your sound. Huh?
Well, what about your role as a student? Because Leon Fleischer was one of your great teachers. Do you play for him?
I've played for him probably 5 to 10 times since leaving, and I've developed, I would say, a handful of people who, you know, like what you were describing with Robert, that like I really trust them, and I also really trust that they would I trust that they would tell me because they have told me, you know, and that's really invaluable, I find, you know, because you.
Sometimes it's not always easy to get back to the person you trust either, or, you know, if I'm having a Skype, I mean, people now Skype lessons, I don't know how accurate this is either, but, you know, I mean, that's why it's nice when you're working to be able to trust these people that you're with, to kind of say, well, maybe this is a little, you know.
Yeah, that's a great thing, one of the many great things for me about being a Marlboro is that there are certain people who I've known for now, like, over 20 years, who they know my playing really well, like, you know, Mitsuko, who's my co-director there, you know, she, you know, first of all, we share a lot of, I would say, values, but also she's been following my playing over a long time, you know, period of time. So if she says something, it's from the point of view of remembering what I sounded like 6 months ago and a year ago and 2 years ago and 10 years ago. And like that perspective also, I think, makes it a lot easier to trust someone.
You know, just speaking personally as a composer, so I had a teacher for 5 years, and it happened that he died right when I finished working with him. So, and I totally believed him, even though I didn't ever want to. That is, almost everything he ever said to me, whether good or bad, I thought, no. And then went home and thought, and yet, he has a point. And then there was no one for years. And then I found a person who was actually a pianist who had done this for John Harbison a lot, and I came to realize her ears were so good that I just needed to listen to anything she said, and then she died. So it's hard.
But it's also wonderful, you know, that you can kind of be a collection of all these different thoughts from all these different people. You know, I really love that about my teacher, that she always encouraged me to study with other people. And I think it's really important because you just, you are an individual, and I think it's nice to not be married to one way of doing things, you know, and it also allows you to, you know, share that with other people.
Very true.
So here's a random question I should know the answer to, and I truly don't. I had two friends who were invited by Rudolf Serkin to Marlborough years ago, and they just did a whole summer of art song projects. Do you still do that?
Anyone who goes to Marlborough will spend the summer doing a lot of different things. So the singers end up working on Lieder, but also working on a lot of vocal chamber music, which is frankly one of my favorite aspects of Marlborough because it's repertoire that's just so magnificent and never gets done anywhere else. So like you hear both, when I say vocal chamber music, I mean both like pieces for multiple voices and then also just works for, you know, groups of instruments with voice. So like the pieces that I had never heard, there's a Hinastera string quartet with soprano in it, which is an amazing piece of music. And you know, the Schoenberg second string quartet gets done in Marlborough, and you know, pieces like Chanson Maricasse and the, you know, I mean, it's just magnificent repertoire. And yeah, so that's what the singers usually end up doing in Marlborough.
Okay. We had Schoenberg Second Quartet last year, and this year we have Lucas Foss Time Cycle, which is on Saturday at 4:30 p.m. This would be a good time to go to the audience and see if you have questions for any of our artists, and write down here, and we'll bring a mic to you.
Hi, I really appreciate your really fascinating and very forthcoming discussion. I want to tell you a story, and I hope you believe my story that's related to your discussion. A few years ago, I was attending a live interview at WQXR in New York, the radio station, and Wynton Marsalis was being interviewed, and the interviewer said to him, "And who? Could you tell us your favorite composer?" And he said, "Yes, Beethoven. He was a cool cat."
So I'm just going to tell a quick story before. And no, go ahead and be ready. But in my first lesson with that teacher I mentioned, Roger Sessions, I'd never had a lesson with him. And I walked in, and he had in front of him a score that was obviously one of his, in those days, handwritten, and Beethoven's Ninth. And they were both side by side on his desk. And I said, I'll come back later. And he said, "No, you know, this is my Ninth Symphony. It's going to be premiered at Carnegie Hall next week. I hope you can come." I said, "Yes, Mr. Sessions, I am coming to that." And he said, "And this is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Well, he was one of our best fellows."
Yes, as someone who attends every chamber symphony and festival orchestra, I'm used to hearing soloists in front of a large orchestra. And usually the balance is good, but it isn't always. As soloists, and of course as a composer too, are you able to influence this? Or how do you attempt to influence the balance?
Well, I think also at different venues, you know, here it might be difficult because it's of the outdoor aspect. Sometimes that can influence. And again, we don't know. You know, sometimes I feel, I mean, I don't have a large voice. I'm going to say that. But, you know, that's kind of the conductor's job to figure that out. you know, because I'm you hope that composers write in a way that, you know, they've been understanding of this, and it might need to lessen the forces behind you when that happens. But sometimes it definitely does, and I've gotten reviews where it says, you know, maybe I could have been heard more. And it's interesting. I find nowadays that a lot of composers just assume they're going to use microphones. John Adams is always done with microphones. There's no... It's never not done with a microphone. So in certain ways, he doesn't have to kind of do anything to the orchestra, and he doesn't. You know, so it's a very... So that makes the microphone kind of an art form in itself, and the person doing it has to be mindful that it doesn't sound like a rock concert or something like that. You know, so it's its own... you know, I think that's a challenge to write for the voice and not cover it with an orchestra.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of practical things worth saying. Usually there is someone in the rehearsal sitting in the audience, either an assistant conductor or some other trusted musician who one can ask. The dynamics, of course, are always complicated, of whether that person is going to be comfortable saying, yes. Are you... and, you know, I think I've certainly had lots of conversations with conductors about certain spots where I maybe had a concern. But I do want to say just one other thing, and this probably applies less to the voice, because, I mean, obviously, you have to be able to hear every word. But I do think that this is one area where recordings have had a really, really bad influence on the way we listen, because I think so many recordings mic soloists in such a way that you hear every note with laser beam clarity above the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's how most of these composers intended the balance to be. I think certainly if you look, you know, at classical concerti, the piano or whatever the soloist is very often woven into the orchestra. The piano is, in fact, sometimes accompanying one or another instrument within the orchestra. And so it's a balance, you know. You need to be able to cut through when you're the primary voice. But I think it's actually not necessarily the worst thing in the world if the soloist comes in and out of absolute prominence over the course.
I agree totally. This spring, I was doing Rachmaninoff's "The Bells" in Dallas, and that hall is beautiful. But also, the orchestra is quite loud, and I asked the assistant conductor to secretly record it. Maybe I shouldn't confess it right now, but and I was listening because the orchestra is so luscious and so beautiful and so big. I was listening to my part, and I was like, "Oh, okay, I can still hear myself, but I'm coming out of the orchestra." Which some other time, the texture of the orchestra, yes, which. If I was singing an opera, I'd be like, oh, well, maybe I should sing a little more. But in that case, the voice becomes part of the orchestration rather than the solo part.
And I think that's true of your solo in this symphony.
Oh, definitely.
Actually, because I've had different conductors tell the soprano not to enter with the chorus because they don't want... If the soprano's in the front, you're going to hear her even though she's singing the same line as the soprano's in the chorus, and you don't maybe don't want that. So I've had conductors say, don't sing until your line emerges.
Exactly.
So it's, I mean, it's very difficult. It's just choices, too, that they make, what they want.
Well, a story here, and don't get any ideas, is last time we did Beethoven 9, the soloist asked if they could stand at the very back with the wall right behind them. They said it felt more comfortable to them in the tent to be projecting with the wall helping them. And we did it. I commented, it's a German phrase, das macht kein schönes Bild. I said, I don't like the way it looks with them back there, but we did it.
But how was the sound?
Good. It was good.
Was it better than if they were a little...
I won't say.
Okay.
I did have the experience of a piano concerto that I wrote being played in the Hollywood Bowl. And I went for the rehearsal, very naive, of course, and I took a seat in the middle where I could hear, I thought, the right blend. And they said, oh, no, you sit way back there in the sound with the sound guy because anything balancing is happening with the sound guy. The people on stage have no responsibility for balance at all. Yeah.
Jonathan, you play 75 concerts a year. You're playing on Yamahas. You're playing on Steinways. If you had a choice of one piano to follow you everywhere, which piano would that be?
Well, I actually, the truth is, I almost always play Steinways because I actually am a Steinway artist. And what I'm about to say is probably been compromised by what I just said because it seems like I'm, you know, contractually obligated to say so. But I will say that a good Steinway for me is actually the most appealing piano to play. Particularly for me, a good Homburg Steinway, I would say, that I just find that the vocabulary of sounds, vocabulary of colors, is broader than any other instrument I know. And in a funny way, it pains me to say it, because I sort of like, in theory, the idea of a world where a really wide variety of instrument makers are represented, and, you know, that used to be that way, that, you know, like Clara Schumann didn't want to play in France because she didn't like the Erards and the Pleyels, you know? So it was like, it was really a regional thing that, you know, the pianos were different everywhere, and I think it's a little bit of a shame that that's no longer the case, but among what's available, I do think that Steinway, when it's, you know, in one of their highest quality instruments and when it's well regulated, it is kind of a marvel, actually.
Okay, well, we've reached the end of our hour. I want to say thank you to Manet Galoyan and Kelly O'Connor and Jonathan Biss. Mahler 2, Sunday at 4. Don't miss that. Beethoven 3rd Piano Concerto, Friday at 6 p.m. Thank you.